WCCO Outdoors on News Talk A3O. Welcome to the broadcast on this Sunday, May 24th, 2026. Happy Memorial Day weekend, everybody. Hope you are enjoying this time with friends and family. Temperatures started to increase today. Looks like it's going to get serious this week with low to mid, even maybe some high 80s later this week. Summer has arrived. That's kind of what Memorial Day is all about, right? The unofficial kickoff to summer. Hope you're out there enjoying some boating, fishing. Still got some turkey hunting going on for a few more days. That goes until the end of the month. So a week from today, I guess, will be the last day of turkey hunting. Good little show here again today. Stan Tequila will be with us a little bit for the second week in a row. Going to talk bears, the grizzly bear thing going on out west with him. That's been in the news a lot the past few weeks. And also a great guest who I don't believe has ever joined me on the program before, Mark Neusel. I've known Mark for many years. He's a professor emeritus of journalism at the University of St. Thomas. He's also a board member on Sportsman for the Boundary Waters, outdoors writer. We're going to talk about smallmouth, speaking of bass, up in the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. If you've been to the B-Dub, you know that smallies are as much a signature species up there as moose and eagles and loons. Well, actually, they haven't been there forever, and we're going to talk to Mark about that a little bit. News-wise, before we talk to Mark, the legislative session, of course, ended last week, and I spoke on this program 7 days ago about those Lessard Sam Outdoor Heritage Council dollars, the Outdoor Heritage Fund, and how it came pretty close to not passing. Now, as of last week's show, we knew it was going to pass. Some of the details of the compromise emerged since then, and I tell you what, there was a lot of wheeling and dealing going on to get that done. If you listen to my comments last week, you know that we've never not gotten that bill passed. We originally voted to dedicate sales tax funding to the outdoors back in 2008, and every year since then, the Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council recommendations have gone through the legislature and gotten done. This felt about as close as we've ever come to that not happening, and that would be a problem, not because you'd lose the dollars, but because they would basically just sit in escrow in an account until the next legislative session. And with things like fuel costs and inflation always increasing, you're eating away at those dollars, the power that they have. You also have vendors out there who are going to do the work that have been lined up for contracting. And if all of a sudden they're not going to get paid, that's a problem. You know, bottom line, these are dedicated funding dollars. You want to see them get in the ground. And, you know, the good news is that the legislature got it done. They locked down the bill and it passed last Sunday, the last day of the session. You know, the bad news is that, you know, there were a bunch of amendments to the bill, especially in the House, where that body is divided, what, 67-67. And there were some Republican amendments to it. And as I said, I think last week, I wasn't really objecting. I didn't really have a problem with any of the amendments. But the fact that it came close to preventing the bill from passing, that was worrisome. And I don't think we've seen this kind of wheeling and dealing before to get it done. Now, when you've got a divided legislature, you're going to see more of that. But the deal that was brokered, I wrote in my column this week, struck me as a little odd. And there was a lot of chatter in the outdoor community about the deal that was brokered. Part of the $191 million that's going to get spent as part of that Outdoor Heritage Fund programming this year includes a little less than 10% for something called the Community Grants Program. This year, that totaled about $14 million of that $191 million. So, you know, well less than 10%. And it's kind of, that money's kind of set aside for smaller communities and groups to apply for, groups that maybe don't have the grant writing infrastructure that some of these big dogs like Pheasants Forever and Ducks Unlimited and the Nature Conservancy have in place. And I think generally those dollars have been split roughly half going to outstate and half in the metro. And, you know, that's a whole other thing. You've got metro legislators who don't particularly like how much of this dedicated funding goes outstate because the metro generates so much more of those sales tax dollars. There's some grumbling about that with metro legislators. And, you know, as a metro resident myself, I get that a little bit. But the cold hard fact is you're going to get a lot more bang for your habitat buck in greater Minnesota, and which is why I completely support the vast majority of those dollars going to places where they can do their best work. But there's metro legislators who that grinds on them, right? If you're a legislator, you always want to return dollars back to your district. And so the deal they brokered over this term limits thing, the Republicans really wanted term limits for Lessard Council members, which, as I said, I don't particularly have a problem with. And I don't think most Democrats would have objected to in theory either, but it was just it gets down to giving up marbles. The Democrats on the committee felt like they'd already given up a couple of marbles on two other points, and they weren't going to give up this term limits thing for council members without a fight or a grand compromise. So what they got was all these community grant program dollars within the LaSard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Fund for this funding cycle only is only going to go to the metro. And like I say, if you figure maybe half the dollars are going outstate before, that's a $7 million swing for metro projects. I had one source wonder, are there enough metro projects to even spend it all in 1 year? I suspect they will, right? They always find a way to spend the money. And there's probably some good outstate projects that aren't going to have access to these dollars this funding cycle only because of this grand compromise. Now, again, the vast majority of the $191 million is still going to go outstate. I don't mean to suggest that outstate conservation projects are going to go unfunded. They're not. They're still going to get the majority of Outdoor Heritage Fund dollars. But this small subset, this community grants program, that's all metro for the coming year. And, you know, the bigger picture isn't maybe so much those dollars just staying in the metro. It's all that wheeling and dealing that went on. I don't like that precedent. I liked when the LaSard Sam Outdoor Heritage Fund bill just kind of went through nice and smooth, got approved. We've got a council that does the process. And if they can wheel and deal this year, well, gosh, maybe they can wheel and deal even more on this bill next year. And that's a little worrisome because this money does really good work. If you monitored the news this past week, Star Tribune, Outdoor News, we both had the stories. Almost 2,000 acres of new public lands up in Clay County, mostly getting its funding from Outdoor Heritage Fund, working with partners like TNC and Pheasants Forever. Two projects in Wright County and close to another 400 acres, less than an hour from the metro. 2,300 new acres of public land in Minnesota, and is going to have all sorts of environmental benefits thanks to this dedicated funding. And I want to make sure we take good care of it so we can renew that baby here in about 7 years. Let's break. When we return, we're going to talk about smallmouth bass up in the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. So don't go away. More WCCO Outdoors after these messages. WCCO Outdoors on News Talk 830. Welcome back to the broadcast on this Sunday, May 24th. I'm Rob Jerisline. We're going to talk with Mark Neusel here in just a moment. He is a hardcore Boundary Waters Canoe Area advocate. He's got some interesting insight on the history of smallmouth bass up there in northeastern Minnesota. And I'm looking forward to talking to him about that a bit. For most people, smallmouth go with the Boundary Waters like mom and apple pie. But you know what? Smallmouth weren't there much more than 100 years ago. We'll talk to Mark about that a bit. But hey, before we talk to Mark, there was an interesting land dedication in Wright County here just northwest of the metro earlier this month. Pheasants Forever and some of its partners dedicated the 214-acre Sukanex Wildlife Management Area Addition and 164-acre Pelican Lake Waterfall Production Area Addition. So there's almost 400 acres of new public lands less than an hour from the Twin Cities out near St. Michael and Monticello along the Interstate 94 corridor. We had a story about that in Outdoor News this week. I always love to celebrate new public lands, and I tip my hat to Pheasants Forever and their partners for pulling that off out there. Make sure you go out and use those acres this fall. That's the most important part about public lands, is actually using them, enjoying them, recreating on them. It is Memorial Day weekend, which is kind of the unofficial kickoff to summer. It's when a lot of people start thinking about heading north and checking out places like the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. A gentleman who has a lot of experience up there, who I don't believe has ever joined me on the broadcast before, is my old friend Mark Neusel. He is a professor emeritus of journalism at the University of St. Thomas. He's done a lot of outdoors writing and a lot of canoe country writing, and he's carved out some time to chat with us now. Mark, it's good to see you. How are you, my friend?
I am great, Rob. Thanks for having me, and it's very exciting to be Memorial Day one more time.
There you go. How many times per year do you figure, on average, you get to the Boundary Waters?
I usually count it as total number of days. And of course, being a teacher, I have mostly summers off. So I try to get up between 20 and 25 days.
Well, that means you've explored the vast majority of the Boundary Waters. You probably spent some time in Quetico too, across the border, I'm guessing.
Sure, sure. It's of course, it's not as easy in Quetico as it once was, but we can still get over if you so desire.
It's not as easy because of the permitting. Is that got
yes,
much?
Yeah. Yeah, and now it changed once again, so there'll be some adjustments, but it'll be okay.
You've been going up to the Boundary Waters for decades. Do you feel like it's changed at all? Has the average visitor, the average length of trips that you see people taking, have those changed? Or does it feel like a pretty similar experience to maybe how it felt 25, 30 years ago.
I don't have data to back me up on this, but I'm pretty sure in saying that the average trip is shorter than it used to be. Mm-hmm. And perhaps the outfitters could weigh in on this too. But I believe, you know, when I first started, you'd go for sure for a week, and often you'd go for a couple of weeks. You know, by the time you get there, you don't just want to turn around and come home. But in my view, in terms of where the permits are and when they're available and how what the usage looks like, it seems like trips are shorter. And I wonder what that's related to. People are busier, I guess. Lives are busier than, or they think their lives are busier than they used to be. I'm not sure that's actually true. But I think folks are less willing to devote maybe a week or two to a wilderness trip than they used to be back in the day.
Do you have a favorite part of the Boundary Waters? Do you tend to go in on the Gunflint side, the Ely side, up through the Sawbill?
Yeah, I don't really have a favorite. I mean, I have favorite lakes if I particularly want to go lake trout fishing, let's say. Fairly limited places to go for lake trout if that's the goal of the trip. Same for other species. Or if you want to do a lot of paddling, if you want to do a circular route or an in and out, or maybe you want to see pictographs or waterfalls or other interesting parts of the geology and the ecosystem up there. So it kind of depends on the mood I'm in, and am I by myself or am I my family or, you know, maybe some buddies.
How did you first start going to the Boundary Waters? Was this something you did with your parents, or did you discover it on your own?
Actually a college experience for me. I mean, my dad had been there for when he was in high school, but of course then he always talked about it as a great place and he was a great fisherman. By the time I got to college, I had the opportunity to go. And it kind of took off from there.
You brought up fishing, and you recently wrote a story on your Substack, which is also going to appear in Outdoor News, about the smallmouth bass of the Boundary Waters. I think a lot of people don't understand smallies aren't necessarily native. And you've done some research into that, huh?
Well, I have. I've seen a lot of misinformation out there, and I'm sure you have too, where, you know, on online forums and places like that, where people just are not exactly, haven't really dug into it in a way. And I wanted to sort of straighten that out as best I could. And it is true that their smallmouth bass are not native to the Boundary Waters area, partly because, of course, on the Lake Superior side, they couldn't get up past the waterfalls.
Sure.
And on the Minnesota side, or on the western side, they're native to the Mississippi River system, but that's not part of the actual Boundary Waters as we think of it, right?
Different watersheds, right?
Different watersheds.
Different divide.
Yeah. Exactly. Got a continental divide in the way. So they were kind of geologically and geographically locked out. But in the early, late 1800s, very early 1900s, the earliest evidence I could find was actually the year 1900. They were brought in by some white settlers who just toted them in buckets. Actually, they came on the Canadian side first in terms of an officially sanctioned stocking. The Ontario provincial government decided in 1901 that smallmouth in that region would be a good thing. So they started to come in just very, very slowly. But it really took about 40 years on the U.S. side for those fish to be stocked legally, if I can use that term, in the late 1930s.
So not that long ago, less than a century ago, on the Minnesota side is when we're talking about smallmouth bass getting stocked there. What was the idea? We wanted to have a sport fish and that fishing opportunity. That'd be my first question. My second question is, how have they altered the ecology or the fishery overall in those lakes? What would have maybe been there prior to their stocking that's not there now, if anything?
Yeah, great questions. They were brought in originally. The place was being advertised heavily as a fisherman's paradise, even in the 1920s and 30s. The outdoor magazines were heavily promoting it as a place for record numbers of fish, record sizes of fish. And of course, they pointed to northern pike and walleye and sturgeon and lake trout as the four big fish to go after in that region. And of course, those were the four largest, you know, predatory fish in the area. And it turns out they're kind of hard to catch.
And they're slow growing species also.
And in that part of the world, they're very slow growing. And guess what? When you're, you know, all hype, you're city bred, you're all hyped up about going up there, you're going to catch a big mess of fish. You've seen photos of big piles of fish, mm-hmm. you know, in front of the outfitter sign. And oh my gosh, we're just going to slaughter them. And then you get up there and you find out, hey, it's kind of hard to catch a lake trout. Where are they?
Well, yeah, they're before electronics and all that. Yeah.
That's right. And they're 105 feet deep and you're in the middle of July and it's not going to work. It's not that easy.
No,
it's never that easy. Even for guys that are experienced, it's not that easy. So there was a demand for something easy. And thus the smallmouth bass was born into the region because, of course, they're easier to catch. And they took to the ecosystem just as quickly as possible because it's got, you know, rocky bottoms, cooler water. The habitat couldn't have been better, really. And once folks like Sigurd Olsen and friends, civic boosters, others started dumping them in, they took off. And this would have been in the 1940s. The heavy stocking probably ended by the early 50s, I would guess.
It's amazing to hear you say some of these names who are involved, because now you don't just randomly stock fish. Now that would be considered an ecological disaster to just, you know, dump a new species into these pristine waters. But back then, even some of these guys that we revere, like Sigurd Olsen, were like, hey, this is a great opportunity to go fishing.
Well, remember, he also owned an outfitting business, so he had a commercial interest in it. But I like to think of them, and I don't know if I've created this term or not, but it fits. I like to call them bucket biologists, where they just load up a 5-gallon bucket full of whatever and you know, dump it. And you've seen this all over the country, too. I mean, it's not just Minnesota, of course, but it was more popular in those days. And now there are laws against it. You know, your second question is a good one. What did it do to the ecosystem? As we know, you know, with the introduction of any new species, which older species get pushed aside? The answer is it's probably too soon to say because it's really pretty recent in geologic time in terms of this introduction. What we do know, I think what we can say from the data that I've seen, and of course, I rely on guys like Myron Heintzelman and others who just know that area like the back of their hand, and they say the jury's still out, but it looks like the smaller lakes were affected more greatly, and it's the bigger fish in the smaller lakes that are fewer. So the big pike, the big lake trout, the big walleye that were in smaller bodies of water are fewer because of the competition with the smallmouth. One thing I think that we can say for sure is that if you're in a smaller body of water, the likelihood of trophy fish there is less than it would have been without the smallmouth in it.
Again, you can read more about this in Outdoor News. Mark's going to have a story about this as well as at his Substack account. We're chatting with Mark Neusel. He is a professor emeritus of journalism at the University of St. Thomas and an avid Boundary Waters enthusiast. Mark, unfortunately, we're almost out of time, but before we go, I want to talk about a book you've got coming out this fall called Rooted in the North. It's a profile of a lot of the great classic Minnesota nature writers, including, we mentioned Sigurd Olsen.
That's right. 20 writers trying to bring back some from obscurity. Obviously, Olsen would not be one of those. Many of the writers our listeners have heard of, like Sigurd Olsen, Eric Severide, Cal Rutstrom, Justine Kerfoot, Grace Lee Newt, Helen Hoover. But I also was interested in writers from the past who have been kind of forgotten and who need to be introduced to a new audience. And if I could just give you one quick example, I'm thinking of a fellow named Charles Hallock, H-A-L-L-O-C-K. You've possibly been to Hallock, Minnesota, in the far northwestern part of the state in Kitson County. That's him. He was the founder and the owner of Forest and Stream Magazine, which merged into Field and Stream Magazine, and a very important outdoor writer in the 19th century, pretty much forgotten. So I'm trying to bring authors of books, and it's not just nonfiction, but a few fiction writers as well, trying to bring them to a new audience and try to understand how Minnesota was crafted as this outdoor paradise, which it is, and how that was presented to the reader.
And this book will be available this fall. Is that correct, Mark?
University of Minnesota is the publisher. It'll be out probably November, December. Small paperback, easy to put in your backpack or your tackle box and throw it at the end table at your cabin.
If folks want to read your Substack writing between now and then, where do they find that?
So go on Substack, and we're at Just a Bit Outside. Just a Bit Outside on Substack. You can also just look for my name on Substack. And I focus on the small things in nature.
It's an outdoors Substack account, not a baseball account, just to get outside, huh?
I'm trying to draw in a few baseball fans.
There you go. Mark, it was good to catch up with you. Thanks for spending a segment with me. Safe travels to you this summer.
All right, Rob. Always a pleasure.
Our friend Mark Neusel, again, look him up at a Substack, and also you'll see his byline in Outdoor News. Let's grab a break. More of the broadcast after these messages. WCCO Outdoors on News Talk 830. Welcome back to the broadcast on this Sunday, May 24th. Stan Tequila will be with us in just a moment. We're going to talk non-game topics with him. Little bonus non-game issue. I see Dateline out of Ottumwa, Iowa. That's in southeast Iowa. The Iowa DNR confirmed the rare sighting of a newborn white fawn on the Indian Hills Community College campus last week. They were urging the public to steer clear of it. I've seen a lot of white deer in my life, but a white fawn is pretty remarkable to see. The Iowa DNR telling the public that white deer represent fewer than 1% of Iowa's deer population. I presume the number is similar up here in Minnesota. And the law in Iowa protects white deer. I believe it's the same in Wisconsin. And if I have it right, Minnesota, we do not protect white deer, and I don't think we should. That's a whole other story we don't need to get bogged down in. Let's talk some other fun non-game topics now with our friend Stan Tequila, who's joining us for the second week in a row. Stan, hey, good to see you. Thanks for carving out time for another segment with me.
Hey, Rob, good to see you too. Thanks for having me on.
You know, a couple things I want to talk about this week, maybe more on last week we talked a lot about migration, nesting. Let's talk about things with teeth, big teeth this week. I've talked a lot the past couple weeks about the cougars in northern Minnesota with cubs. Yeah. Quite a story, huh?
That's pretty amazing. And it's good to see that there's at least some areas in Minnesota with some that's wild enough yet to be able to contain the largest of our predators, feline predators. So it's pretty exciting to see it. It really is. And it was just a matter of time before it happened. It's one of those things, you got enough eyes out there, you're bound to see everything.
Well, there are a lot of eyes out there these days with all those trail cameras. And as I wrote in my column, this is exciting. It's cool. There's a lot of people, claiming that we've got cougars all over the place. And I made the point in my column, it's not a coincidence that these were photographed in darn near the most wild spot. Yes. In Minnesota. These are incredibly secretive creatures. They need big space. They need space from people. And, the other cougar cubs that we have seen in the Western Great Lakes region is, west of Ontonagon, the Porcupine Mountains of Upper Peninsula, Michigan, maybe the second most wild place in the Upper Great Lakes. I mean, these are two incredibly remote places, and that's not a coincidence.
Right. They need those kind of areas away from people and has to have enough of a prey base to be able to get them by. By the way, when they're in the West, we call them mountain lions. When you're down other parts of the country, you call them cougars, or down in South America, they call them puma. But they are all exactly the same animal. There's no difference between them. So that's one of those things that people confuse all the time.
I believe one of the most widespread species, at least historically on the continent.
Historically speaking, it was across the entire United States. Every single state had mountain lions or cougars or whatever you want to call them. And they were everywhere. And we did a really good job at wiping them out. And they had, a few strongholds where they hung in there. And generally speaking, right now, it's believed that the Black Hills of South Dakota is probably the epicenter for a lot of these mountain lions to radiate out from and move into new territories. And it was just a matter of time before one found Voyageurs National Park, the Boundary Waters area, that kind of a very, literally a wilderness that they were able to take up residency. And, these animals find each other. They do what comes naturally. And lo and behold, you got some cubs. And I think it's really exciting and very, very cool to see.
That kind of sparks the conversation about bears a little bit. And these species, we associate with being mountain dwelling species. And that's because that was the one place they could survive, after humanity kind of took over all the flatland. Grizzly bears, for example, they were a prairie animal. And there's a little bit of chatter out west as those grizzly bears expand up out of the mountains, and they're just fine. They're more than happy to wander the flatland of some of those western states, Montana and Wyoming, and get into crops. So we're seeing some renewed debate, over grizzly bears out west as they reclaim some of that historic flatland prairie habitat. And, you know, on the topic of bears, we had a couple bear attacks, one in Glacier, one in Yellowstone. The last I heard, they suggested they both could have been on the exact same day. It was a couple, was it Monday the 4th, I believe, that happened. All sorts of chatter about this. What does it mean? Are there too many bears now? You know, like in the case of Glacier, I don't think there'd been a fatality in Glacier for 30 years. So does that mean the week before there weren't enough bears?
Good point.
What do you make of all? You've encountered a lot of big bears in your day, Stan.
Yeah. So, you know, over my 40 years, some career, I've spent a lot of time out in Yellowstone, Tetons, and there was a time 30 years ago, you did not see grizzlies. Because there was not that many of them, and you would see black bears, but you just wouldn't see grizz. And it's just been slowly increasing over the years to now you can pretty much guarantee you're going to see a grizzly when you're out in, you know, out in Yellowstone. So it's not unusual. By the way, just a little point of clarification. So grizzly bear is the name for the subspecies of brown bear. So the grizzlies that we have in Yellowstone and in Glacier are a subspecies of the brown bear. Brown bears found circumpolar, meaning all around the world, and the smallest subspecies of the brown bear is the grizzly bear, and it's found in the Intermountain West. So this is found, you know, Glacier, Yellowstone, Tetons type of thing. And it's the one who eats mainly plant material. And that's probably why they're the smallest, because they are they have mostly a vegetarian diet. And I've always joked that the reason why grizzlies are such a problem is because they're hungry all the time. They're eating grass and sedges and you know, green leaves all the time, and they're just looking for some protein, and they're kind of irritable all the time. And so
they're surly.
And so when they're surprised by a hiker or something like that, they their natural response is to kind of neutralize whatever it is that surprised them or whatever kind of caught them off guard, and then they run into these problems with them too.
You're listening to WCCO Outdoors. We're chatting with Stan Tequila. Questions for you, Stan. One, so, well, first of all, an observation. And I've been kind of monitoring what's going on in Europe, and bears, the brown bears of Europe are reclaiming. They're expanding.
They're coming back.
They got them down in Romania. Are there some in Spain? I've seen a map recently. It's interesting. Those are actually larger than our grizzly bears? Because I've seen a lot of pictures where I thought they looked a hair smaller, or at least no bigger.
Yeah, all you have to do is go to compare them to the Alaska brown bears, and you'll see. Anything that's near the coast, any brown bears near the coast, they're eating a high protein diet with fish.
I'm with you there. I get that. I'm talking about these European, Central European bears.
Yes, they'd be along the lines of the grizzly bear of the.
That's what okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they'd be very, very similar in that they are the smallest of them all. They're, you know, the environmental pressures where that animal lives dictates the size and the appearance of that animal. The ones that are in the Intermountains where they don't have access to all those fish, they're much, much smaller than the ones that are like along the coast.
Sure. And like those bears of the Ketchikan Peninsula of Siberia, they look a lot like the bears in Alaska or coastal Alaska.
They're the same genus and species. They're exactly the same thing.
Eating the same kind of food, having a good time.
Yep, exactly.
Well, anyway, some bear talk for you there. And, you know, meanwhile, we got black bears, which are, we did a story on black bears in the paper here recently, Stan, where one of the DNR, I forget, Andrew Trier, was talking about how black bears are arguably the most successful predator on the planet, you know, large predator on the planet in terms of, in terms of number, there's like more black bears in North America than all other bears worldwide combined.
Yeah. Well, first of all, you have to understand there's 8 different species of bear, and the black bear, there's a reason why it's called the American black bear, because it's only found in the Americas. It's not found in Europe, Asia, Africa, things like that. So it's not a really good comparison, is it? The brown bear is found all over the world. And so that would be a little bit better one to compare to, because that's found everywhere. And that's probably a much more successful species. It's just that we knocked it back so far, in our paving the way for civilization. And given enough time, they'll come back and do well also. And that's
they're much larger, Stan. They've got a bigger home range than a black bear. I mean, there's probably more black bears in California than there are brown bears worldwide.
Could be. Yeah, could very well be. And reminder that black bears go all the way far down south as Florida. And so you've got black bears in Florida too, and all through the Smokies, all through the, you know, the Appalachian Mountains. And so you've got a big, huge, and again, it was just like you were saying earlier with the brown bear, black bears were usually found all over the place. And we've, you know, pushed it back to these areas where they could hold out. And now they're starting to come back with, you know, enough protection that they're doing well.
One other odd bear note stand that I saw, I read a story somewhere, I forget what the source was, that was basically ranking the meanness or the number of fatalities associated with the eight bear species that you just mentioned. And interestingly, it's a couple of the eight smaller Asian bears that kill a whole lot more people than even polar bears or grizzly bears do.
Wow.
Like the Japanese bear kills a fair number. And then there's one in India. You probably know more than I have the species.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe it's just the proximity to so many people.
The speckled bear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could be. Yeah, maybe that was it. Mm-hmm. Their proximity to such dense populations.
That's what I was going to say.
People that has something to do with it. But
yeah, the contact that they have is higher.
Yeah, but nonetheless, some of those Asian bears kill far more people than our grizzly or brown bears or even polar bears do. That said, I still wouldn't want to be out on the tundra with nothing between me and a polar bear stand, which you probably experienced a time or two.
I've done a bunch of times, and when they walk by you and you're standing there on the ground and you can barely look over their back because, I mean, these bears are 1,200 pounds. It's like a automobile going by. They are a formidable predator. I love them. They're really pretty
and
amazing.
Stan, we should be cool. When you're out there, you have backup. You've got guys with noisemakers and rifles, right?
Oh gosh, yeah. That would be a suicide mission to be out there with polar bears and not have a guide who is has all the noisemakers and then also has, you know, the bear spray and also has got, you know, fully loaded, you know, handguns, shotguns, the whole thing. You have to otherwise. And the best thing is to know what they do and how they, you know, their behaviors.
Read their body language.
Yeah. Read their body language and then avoid putting yourself in a bad situation. That's the main thing. People do it all the time, though.
And that applies to any, you know, in dealing with any bears, grizzlies, black bears, whatever.
Yep. You got
it. Yeah, Stan, we talked a lot about bears. That was fun, though. It's always a fun topic. You write about bears periodically, naturesmart.com. I'm sure you've got some past columns on the bear topics.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And then plus every spring I lead a photo tour. So people can go to naturesmart.com and look at my photo tours. I have a photo tour just for black bears. So are people interested in going out and photographing with me, with black bears, that's available there also.
Naturesmart.com. Stan, thanks. We'll talk to you later this year.
All right. Sounds good.
And our buddy Stan Tequila. Appreciate him joining us. Let's break more of the broadcast after these messages.
Welcome back, everybody, to this Memorial Day weekend edition of WCCO Outdoors. I'm Rob Gerisline. We've got just a few minutes left. Before we go, a couple congratulations are in order. First off, to Doug Hartke. Doug is the 2026 Outdoor News Person of the Year. That award goes back to the late 1990s, about 1998. Every year, we honor someone who represents the best of Minnesota conservation, volunteerism, especially. We like to highlight. We like to focus on people who maybe aren't getting paid to be conservationists as part of their profession, but are doing it just out of pure love for natural resources, as well as their fellow citizens who are benefiting from their work. Again, this year's recipient is Doug Hartke. He is out of Martin County in southwestern Minnesota, where he's a member of the Fox Lake Conservation League. And these folks have done absolutely incredible work securing public lands, easements, habitat restoration, wetland restoration. If you listen to my first segment where I talked about the Outdoor Heritage Fund, the dedicated funding dollars and how important those are for habitat work across the state, this is a guy who is leveraging those dollars to do great work. A gentleman who is volunteering his time to make sure your tax dollars are going into worthy projects that are benefiting water quality and fish and wildlife habitat. I don't think we could have picked anybody better than Doug Hartke. Great guy. Congratulations to him. And then going to the exact opposite corner of the state up in the Ely area, my friend Matthew Schultz. Matt has been the program director with Sportsman for the Boundary Waters for 3 years, going on four, something like that. He's been on this show before. A great young guy. He's going to be leaving Sportsman for the Boundary Waters, and I'm sorry to hear that. I hope they are able to find someone as great as Matt to fill his shoes. But Matt is taking a job. I'm writing about this for my column next week. Matt is taking a job with Orvis. Of course, if you're into fishing, you know all about Orvis and their fly fishing gear and their other fishing equipment. Matt's new job title will be Fly Fishing Travel Specialist. I laughed aloud when he told me that. I said, that's a job. People get paid to be fly fishing travel specialists. He admitted a lot of people had probably applied for the job, but he got it. Congratulations to him. It sounds like he's going to be traveling the world, looking at destinations and testing them out, so to speak, for potential Orvis clients to go and enjoy via Orvis's travel division. So congratulations to him. Hardworking young man. I'm glad to see him get a position like that. And congratulations to Matt and his fiance, Claire Sebald, who are getting married this coming Saturday, May 30th. They live up in the Ely area. Matt tells me they're going to continue to live up there because they love the Boundary Waters. And even though he's going to be traveling a lot around the world, they're still going to be spending a lot of time paddling America's most important, I dare say, and certainly most visited wilderness, the Boundary Waters canoe area. So congratulations to those two. I hope everybody, again, is enjoying a great Memorial Day weekend. You've got another full day off tomorrow. Take advantage of it. Get out fishing, hiking, maybe even some turkey hunting. So with that, everybody have a great week out of doors. I'll join you again on the station in 7 days. This has been WCCO Outdoors.